This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com. This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewski, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
We're digging into the heart of another case that we've been covering for many a years, one of the biggest injustices that I think we've seen, Richard Allen and the Delphi case, one of the most contested criminal conviction history in recent history. The state of Indiana versus Richard Allen, the man sentenced to 130 years for the Delphi murders. Beyond the headlines, it was a story that raises serious legal and ethical red flags. Jailhouse calls made after months in solitary, psychiatric deterioration ignored, and a confession, if you can even call it that, ordered in the middle of a mental health collapse. The man who's been here for all of it, and in the courtroom, the very secretive courtroom that no one could get into while the trial was actually going on, Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, joining us. I know there's some activity going on in the world of appeals. I want to start there. I looked at some of the documents that you've posted, and my head's already spinning because I'm not a defense attorney. So, could you enlighten Please. Us a little bit on what the hell is going on? What's the latest now in this case in terms of where things are going?
Yeah. So where we're at right now is basically in the beginning stages of the appellate process. So anytime somebody's convicted for a crime and they have intent on appealing, first thing that has to be done in the process is, you know, and I'm not counting anything that might need to be filed at the trial court level before you can file your notice of appeal. I'm talking after a notice of appeal, mm-hmm. which is just that. Like, a notice of appeal is just saying to the appellate court, hey, we're going to be filing an appeal. Here's our notice to protect us under the statute. So we're not waiving anything. So that was done. And then the next thing that they have to do is they have to put the record together. Mm-hmm. The record's everything. So that's the trial transcripts, it's all the exhibits, because that is what the appellate court uses to see what happened down below. Mm-hmm. Not just during the trial, but also during the pretrial phase. So during all the motions that were being denied without hearing over and over and over. All of those things are going to be raised during the appeal. So that takes quite a while. Mm-hmm. And then once the record is certified, meaning they've got it put together and they're saying, okay, here you go, appellate court, here's a certified record, that step is then completed. Now here it's been completed. They have a certified record. So at that point, the onus then shifts onto the appellant, which in this case is Richard Allen and his mm-hmm. attorneys. And they have to get their brief filed. So what we've seen over the past, I think, 3 months now is Allen's attorneys have needed to get extensions for various reasons, most of which seem to be dealing with some of the exhibits don't appear to be in the record.
Okay.
Now, if you followed the case at all, if you haven't, in the Richard Allen case, also known as the Delphi case, there was a huge filing pretty early on in that case, and it was something called a Franks memo.
Mm-hmm.
And a Franks memo, or a motion for a Franks hearing, is essentially saying, just the real nuts and bolts kind of definition of it, that law enforcement went in front of a judge and either lied or misstated or omitted something that may have affected the judge's decision as to whether or not to issue a warrant. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, one of the attorneys, Andy Baldwin, had filed this 136-page Frank's memo. I had never seen anything like it. It reads like a kind of a fantasy novel. It's insane. Mm-hmm. I know, Tony, you've covered it, but it's, you know, it's got Odinists and, mm-hmm. you know, marauding bands of Odinists, you know, kidnapping girls and, you know, white supremacists. And it's got all this stuff. It's, you know, it's got the sticks and the runes and everything. It's unlike anything that I've ever seen in terms of a legal filing. So at any rate, when they filed that 136-page document, along with that was a ton of exhibits, okay? The exhibits are what are at issue right now. So Rick Allen's attorneys are saying, hey, obviously the Franks memorandum and the repeated request for a hearing over the course of a year, and that being denied, and rulings in that Franks, when they finally did get a hearing on it, and her rulings with regard to the third-party culprit stuff, it was contained within the Franks. We need to litigate that. And in order to fully litigate it, we have to make sure that the appellate court has all the exhibits. So this is where the problem is right now. And usually when I'm an Illinois attorney, I've got a lot of attorneys that I know very well and I trust implicitly in Indiana. And one of them is a lawyer named Karen Winicky. She's an appellate lawyer, criminal appellate lawyer out there. And, you know, she kind of knows, because every jurisdiction's different. You mm-hmm. know, like Arkansas is going to be different than Illinois. Illinois is going to be different than Massachusetts. You know, every jurisdiction has their own rules. So what I kind of like to do, I think what might be helpful if I can figure out where it is, if you don't mind, mm-hmm. I kind of like, if you don't have it, I'd like to throw up the most recent court order that came down. Let me see if I can share it. Let me see if I can figure out which window it's in. This might be tougher than anticipated. Let me see. You
is
know
this
what?
One that's on your ex?
Yeah, you know what? I'll pull up Kara's page because she's okay. got it right there. All right. So this is the order that came down on October 3rd. Okay. And this kind of gives us a little bit of idea of where the appellate court's at mm-hmm. the present time. And it says the appellant has filed a verified motion to compel transmission of exhibits and asking for a new due date. The appellant states the transcript does not include certain exhibits, specifically the exhibits filed with the appellant's September 18th, 2023 motion for Frank's hearing and exhibits 3A and 3B that were filed with the appellant's January 20th, 2025 motion to correct error. So that the motion to correct error, just so people understand, was filed post-conviction. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in Illinois, before you file for an appeal after your client is convicted, we have to file a motion for a new trial. It's a mandatory step that we have to take before we file our notice of appeal. In Indiana, they don't have that step. In Indiana, they have the option of filing a motion to correct errors. I think, Tony, you and I covered that pretty thoroughly on one of our episodes together. There was some kind of mind-blowing stuff in there, a lot of new information that came out. And so that thing was filed, and that particular thing carried a lot of new evidence, but it also was essentially saying, look, all these things went wrong before and during the trial.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'd like to get a new trial. You know, obviously you knew Gull was not going to grant it, but it was important to make the record. So
yeah.
That's what they end up doing. So And then in that, there was also a ton of exhibits that were filed. Okay. So the and here's where it gets sticky. So these exhibits were not offered or admitted during a trial or a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, like, if I'm at trial and say, for instance, I have a piece of evidence that I want to get in and I forget during my case in chief, which it happens. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, lawyers have a lot of moving parts during a trial and, you know, on occasion, we're all human beings. And on occasion, sometimes an exhibit, you'll forget to get it entered. You have to get it on the record and entered for it to be a part of the record. Now, I'm not saying that's what happened here, or maybe it did. I don't know. Whatever the case may be, the exhibits that were attached to the Franks memo were not entered into evidence, okay? Which means that they're not going to be showing up in the docket, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's where the problem is. So thus, they are not a part of the transcript. However, these exhibits are part of the clerk's record, okay? So when Andy filed it, and I know he filed, and I'm talking about Andrew Baldwin, one of the attorneys, he filed the memo itself electronically. I don't know if they attached the exhibits electronically or if they went in and hand-delivered the exhibits because they're voluminous.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I tend to think that they may have brought them in, but it does say that they are part of the clerk's record. So the clerk's acknowledging that they have them and that they were filed, but they weren't filed during a hearing or a trial. So it's different. When you're filing with the circuit clerk, it's different than filing with the court clerk and getting it entered as evidence. They're two different things. So the order then says, look, all right, go over to Appellate Rule 2E. And as such, the exhibit should be provided in the appellant's appendix. Okay. And then they cite the rule, Appellate Rule 50B. And then they make this ruling. So having reviewed the matter, the court finds and orders as follows. One, that the appellant's verified motion to compel transmission of exhibits and new date is granted in part as a final extension, meaning, okay, we're granting this kind of because we're saying that we're telling you, look, those exhibits weren't in the transcript, which means it's not in the record that they received the certified record. However, we do see that it is a part of the clerk's record. Therefore, you can get it in front of us through your appendix when you file your brief. Okay. So because an appellate brief is a very lengthy document, you have a table of cases with all the cases you cite. And then eventually you have an appendix that's going to contain all your exhibits and other things as well.
Okay.
So they're saying that that's where it should be. Did you have a question?
No. I mean, I'm trying to follow along as best I can and connect the dots.
That's a lot.
Because I guess my translation would be it's a bunch of bureaucratic bullshit that really, I mean, I get there's purpose to it, but come on, for the love of God, there's got to be clearer ways of handling these things in the way we do.
I mean, you're thinking way too commonsensically. I mean,
I know.
That is
the law, Tony.
Come on.
I know.
Common sense when it comes to the courts, Tony, you know better than that.
Let's make it 50 hoops of fire.
Yeah. And you know, with glass under your feet.
Yes.
So they're kind of granting it, but they're not. But then they are granting the final extension. So they're calling it a final extension.
Okay.
And that's problematic because the appellant, so they're now, and then they go on to say in number two that the appellant's brief is due on October 21st, which is coming around the corner very, very quickly. Here's the problem from the appellate attorney's perspective is that when you're writing the brief, they are the ones that don't have it either. So not only does the appellate court, who doesn't have anything in front of them of substance yet, they don't have it. But more importantly, at this point, the appellate attorneys for Richard Allen don't have it. Now, again, Tony, you're probably sitting there thinking, well, why the fuck don't they just call Andy Baldwin and say, hey, man, can you send me over all the exhibits that you put in with the Franks memo? And then that would solve the problem in terms of them being able to start preparing that portion of their brief with regards to, you know, and mean, I'm assuming that that's taking place. I don't know what's happening with that part of it. All right. Like, I don't know if they still don't have it when they're filing a motion to compel a transmission of exhibits. That tells me that they still don't have it. You know what I'm saying? So
is it time for Richard Allen to get new attorneys?
There's a good question.
At this point, the trial attorneys have no hand in this.
I know. But if we're going to trace some of these problems back in time, and I get people are human and all this, but thank God that they stood up and they wanted to do this pro bono. And I know they went through hell, and I applaud them for all that. But I mean, if this is the issue and they're not giving that to the appellate attorney, I don't know what the excuse is. I mean, we're literally talking like, literally, okay, can we have that? Does it have to be securely sent in some sort of fashion? Can it be a PDF that they email over? Is it literally click send? What are we talking about?
Oddly enough, I'm having Andy Baldwin on my channel tonight, and I'm gonna ask him flat out. Yeah. And Andy's never one to shy away.
I've seen him on you before. I respect him. Yeah, I want to know what the hell's going on.
Right. What we want to know is what's the fix.
Yes.
Like, how do we repair this so that everybody has what they can have, so we can just have a straight up appeal filed without any of the bullshit and let the appellate courts decide where this thing lands?
Because right? They got a track record of bullshit with them, and it's not necessarily always on them. I mean, things getting stolen from the office and all that shit that made everything. It's like some people can be kind of clustery. I don't know that I don't know, but it's like there's a pattern. There's a pattern. Let's not make this the norm, I guess, is the point.
100%. So Kara Winicky, just to kind of finish off that court order, and again, she's an Indiana appellate attorney. She says, read the order carefully. It does not compel the trial court clerk to provide the exhibits to appellate counsel. Instead, it says that the exhibit should be included in the appellant's appendix as they are part of the record. The trial clerk should have a copy of those exhibits to provide to counsel.
Should.
Exactly.
Should and does are two different things.
Exactly. So, and then she goes on to say, but if she does not have a copy, talking about the clerk, the counsel may need to file a motion to stay or stop or halt or pause the proceedings and recreate the missing portion of the record. Appellate Rule 32 lays out the process. Now, we're not going to torture our viewers here by digging into that. I mean, the bottom line that you're seeing is it's a clusterfuck. Yeah. Everything that's gone on with this particular case and Richard Allen's life has been a clusterfuck since the date of arrest. And, this is his first shot at getting a new trial. It's always your direct appeal. And, depending on who you ask, some think that he has an excellent shot at the appellate level to get it. Others don't. Others think it's going to come from post-conviction, which is a whole different can of worms. And that's a thing where I am of the mindset, along with some other attorneys in Indiana, that investigation should be underway now. Because of the age of the case, because you have witnesses that are aging and memories that are fading, and this thing is 8 years in. Mm-hmm. And, if you wait through the appellate process, you could be tacking on another 6 months to a year. And then you're talking about starting the post-conviction investigation basically from scratch. Okay. And just so you understand the difference between post-conviction work and direct appeals, is direct appeals deal with issues at the trial court level and are only limited to what happened in pretrial hearings and the trial. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it is not the place for you to bring up newly discovered evidence. So if you uncovered something after the trial, you can't run in your appeal and say, oh, Richard Allen needs a new fucking trial because we uncovered who really did it. They wouldn't hear it on direct appeal. That comes through a post-conviction petition, okay?
So that's where you would introduce new evidence that you found.
Okay. Exactly. So, okay. So anything that you're digging up after the fact, or that you dug up post-conviction, or that maybe you dug up prior to the trial finishing, but for whatever reason, trial counsel and the state was not aware of this evidence, and it passes muster as being newly discovered, because that's part of the evaluation. The court will always look, well, was this truly newly discovered, or was this available to the parties prior to trial and they just mm-hmm. missed it? If they just missed it, as shitty and hardcore as it sounds, the appellate court's gonna see that's on you. You know, we understand that it's a powerful piece of evidence. However, you know, based on what we're seeing, it appears that it was available to you. You all just missed it because it was in the discovery or whatever the case may be. Then you have to try to litigate that to see if you can get them to, you know, kind of bend their will and allow it in. So where I'm at with this thing is I would have liked, because starting the post-conviction investigation in no way, shape, or form affects the direct appeal. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not anything that would hamper the direct appeal at all. And you can be talking to people that you need to be talking to, that, you know, because there were a lot of people on that trail that day.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah.
And what these people saw, if you followed the trial at all through the creators such as myself and mm-hmm. and Andrea and Lawyer Lee, who were in the courtroom, what became very, very clear is that no two people saw the same thing in terms of the person they were describing. Mm-hmm. If we were to put up every description of what they're terming bridge guy looked like, every single description is different.
Well, they could have seen different people and been submitting that information.
Are they describing him in the same person?
That's my point. Yeah.
That's what Stacey's saying. And it's a great point. And it could be the absolute truth. It could be multiple people that different people are describing. So you know, all these people have to be talked to. There's going to be things that were found in the voluminous tips file, which was 15,000 tips came in on this mm-hmm. case over the course of 5 years. And some of them are mind blown. You know, some of these tips are like, oh my God, why didn't anybody like look into this shit? Why, you know, people that were saying they were out searching, you know, at the time that the initial search ended, they were still out there, and there's just things out there that have to be fully investigated,
mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
know, because everybody who's of the mindset that Richard Allen, because you can think two things that are kind of inconsistent with one another. You can believe that Richard Allen was railroaded and still not be necessarily sold on the fact that he didn't do this. You can think both of those things, and you're fine in thinking that. You know, I think that there's, you know, anybody who's looked at the way that this thing went down and who's being intellectually honest cannot say that this is how the process is supposed to work. From like not just the pretrial hearings and the way that the judge handled the entire proceeding from beginning through trial, but the fact in how this man was kept. I don't care if you're the biggest monster that's ever walked the face of the earth. We have to have faith that the system is going to work and that person's going to get their just desserts when trial is had and whatever punishment is meted out. That's the system that we've chosen. You can't start throwing people that are innocent until proven guilty, who are pretrial detainees, into a fucking prison for 13 months and have them held in solitary confinement so they lose their mind, start eating their shit, start pounding their head against the fucking wall in order to elicit some kind of confession, because you're worried that your case, in terms of the evidence you have, is not strong enough. Well, no one's ever going to convince me. Oh, go ahead, you guys.
Why don't they just do that in every case? Then the prosecution will always win. The DA will always be right, and you'll drive everyone insane. I mean,
isn't that the slippery slope?
You could do it. Yeah, I mean, you could do it that way. If we're going to allow it here, then we should allow it for everyone. Everybody who's arrested for any charge, put them in solitary until they confess.
Minor, major, anything. We're just going to start putting you in solitary until eventually you lose your shit. And a guard says, hey, you want to get out of solitary? Just tell us you did it. You say, I did it.
Yep.
That's a simple
problem
bit.
Solved. Only in America, dreaming in red, white, and blue. Only in America. We'll put you in a cage because we want to. Gull's gonna go over there, put a little stick in your cage and poke. Only in America.
Can I throw something in here?
But before you get something in here, Stacey, can we get that burned onto a CD so I can listen to it?
Oh, it's burned in my head.
I'm going to make you a mixtape. We're going to go back even further.
I'm working on it already, guys.
We're going to mixtape that shit. Yeah.
So we've had a couple of really good questions in the chat. Help Me Rhonda once said, I'm still hopeful the Innocence Project will get involved in this. What do you think the chances are of that? And could that be a successful route to getting this out in the open?
Yeah, more resources.
Yeah, I think it's very, very high that the one of the Indiana, and just to understand that most states have multiple innocence projects. Like, so Notre Dame has one in particular. I know for a fact that that Richard Allen's case has been put in front of them. In terms of whether or not they've come on board officially yet, I don't know, but I know that it is on their radar. I'm very much hoping that they're going to pick up the mantle if the direct appeal doesn't work. And again, when you're talking about innocence projects, they're not going to come on and handle the direct appeal.
Right.
That's going to be the post-conviction work. So, yeah, I mean, you want a powerhouse like that because you want to have that kind of gravitas behind you in terms of your reputation, moving forward and saying, okay, look, if ND's Innocence Project, they're taking it on, we're going to give it some credence because they're not taking on anything that just comes and lands on their desk. They're, they really vet the cases that they're going to look at. So, I mean, that gives it credence right out of the box. And plus, you're just talking about the resources that are available in terms of that kind of entity taking it on. And you really need those types of resources for an investigation like this, because there's just a lot that has to be done. And this case just has so much, because it was cold for 5 years and there was just so much shit out there. I mean, when you go from like all the potential people that were looked at, whether it be Brad Weber, whether it be Ron Logan, whether it be the Holder clan and the Patrick Westfalls and all, there's just a lot of people out there. And Tony, you know that I covered the case heavily, things that I would never report, but the people were in my DMs, dude, like nonstop. And like people, like claiming that they knew shit.
And, oh my God, I still get it every day. I'm sure you do too. Where it's like, like the weird things that people send you. I mean, you get some dandy. Like there are some that are like, okay, this is maybe some credence here. And some like, did your cat tell you to send you that? Is your cat speaking to you? Because I've had some stuff where it's like, look at the pixel here. It's like, it's a pixel.
Yeah. Exactly. There's one dude in particular who I would not be shocked if he's sending you shit too. He's kind of that guy.
I think we know who we're talking about here.
I blocked
him already because he's also the one that claims he wrote the Kim Porter book.
Oh no. I know who that is. Yes.
Yeah.
I've had contact. No, this guy he doesn't have any kind of horse in the race in terms of trying to content creator kind of like a grift like that. This guy has been for 2 years with these, I'd say 5,000 word without one bit of punctuation and the entire stream of consciousness fucking like
that's a mental health problem right there.
Oh my God. But Like everything that I've checked that this guy has ever said in terms of names that he's provided and charges that they've been charged with and connections that these people have, like he is really, really big on that, that this thing had something to do with a meth ring. I'm not willing to discount that.
Yeah. Maybe he's savant. I mean, maybe it could be very savant-like as well with something like that, as far
100%.
As seeing things in such ways that that others don't. We're talking with Bob Motta right now about the case in Delphi. Richard Allen, of course, spending the rest of his life in prison right now, but the appeals process underway. The appeals process does not go fast. It does not go quickly, and it's not super efficient in any way, shape, or form. But we're breaking all of that down right now. And if you have comments or questions, be sure to drop them in the comments section. Let's go way back a little bit because there.
Wait, before you do that, Stacey, yes. Did you say the thing that you wanted to say? I talk so much that I tend to forget whether or not you actually asked your question.
I asked one of them. There was another one I wanted to throw out there from our comment section. People have just been on fire with this. Somebody had asked, Karen asked, is there a time limit for the post-conviction?
No, there isn't. Okay, good. No, there isn't. There is, you know, I mean, time is your enemy in the sense of like what I was talking about earlier. I mean, people pass away, people forget shit, you know, minds change, memories fail, like all that kind of stuff. So in the sense that the sooner the better that you can get to it because, you know, you, like your memory is always freshest right when something happens. Like I've been listening to some of these memory experts and frankly, the guy who testified on Richard Allen's behalf at trial was really interesting. And when he said this, it made complete sense that when you are trying to remember something that is already a memory of something that has happened, you are literally having a memory of the first memory.
Correct.
So things, and it's always evolving. So anything that you may have added to memories of that event ago will now be built upon. And that thing that maybe may or may not have even happened has now become a part of your actual memory of what happened, even though it didn't occur. And as you continue to recall, because we all have those stories, right, in our lives. Like, I always say the best stories are horrible things that happen to us. They always say, you know, like somebody will say, oh, my God, like you won't believe what happened. And I'll say, well, you know, here's the bright thing. You'll always have that incredible story to tell people.
Sure.
It's a horrifying thing. I mean, rarely do you have amazing things that happen to you that are a great story. It's usually something terrible. So point being is that, you know, memories, they're a tough thing. You know, it's like how much can you really trust them because you don't know how much your own mind has added over the course of time to those previous memories that because that's what you're recalling. The last thing that you talked about the memory, you know.
I mean, that is how it works. I mean, that there are false memories. It's a fact of life of how brains work. And it is, I'll say this, it is interesting how in some cases, oh, this is a totally acceptable fact. And then others, it's like false memories. You don't have false memories. Like, you know, Karen Reed case.
He went there. He went to Deborah, Cleaver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever that was. But
whatever her name was.
Whatever that was. And I don't know what to think of that, honest to God.
Yeah.
But it exists. It's not something that is made up by an attorney or this or that. You know, for convenience.
It's not a court move. No,
it is there. It is a thing. Whether you want to believe this person is operating on a false memory is a whole other.
It's the same thing as false confessions. Like people just refuse to believe that those are actually a fucking thing.
We have that in this case, don't we?
We do. We do indeed. We do indeed. I mean, we have them like all over the place. Like
they're
if you watched, I mean, to me, like the most recent example that was a beautiful example of false confessions is that yogurt shop murder case where you had two guys who had absolutely nothing to do with it, who were just a couple of fucking teenagers that used to hang out in this fucking creek behind this mall, smoking weed and fucking skateboarding and just being burnout teenager. Right.
Yeah.
You know, they get them in there and both of these guys confess and they rat one another out to something that neither of them did. They both get convicted. One of them gets sentenced to death. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now they both got overturned around 2009. Yeah. Both of them did fucking 8 years in.
Yeah.
And then last week, all of a sudden, with the magic and the wonder of DNA and IgG, they find out and figure out based on the actual DNA that was left on one of the victims and on a shell casing in a fucking drain who actually did it. And it was a fucking serial killer that just happened to bounce into town, walk in there and did what he did. And it's like,
for
the people that just refused, because here's what the problem is.
Goes against their narrative.
The problem is with false confessions is that we all sit there in our own minds and are like, I would never, never confess to something. I would never say I murdered somebody if they're fucking telling me I did and I didn't do it. I would never do it. And then I'm like, yes, you would.
Yeah, you would.
They're like, yes, you would. That's how this whole thing works.
Yep.
And that was such a great example of it. And it was really fulfilling to have them figure out who had actually committed those heinous crimes against those beautiful kids. So
speaking of memories, obviously, you know, there's a false memory. There's this memories being tainted over time. But what about, you know, wait till this case gets to the point where Richard Allen himself is a memory. What do we know? Obviously he did not do well in prison. He's in prison now. What do we know about his current state in Oklahoma?
Nothing. He's not like people can't even find him. There's people in the Free Richard Allen camp that are searching for him actively in terms, because you can go in any prison, you can go online, you can find out what their inmate number, and you can figure that out a certain way. You can backdoor it by typing in their name. No one can find exactly where he is.
But how is this possible? How is this possible in this system that this is going on, that people cannot find this man and get a conditional update on him?
I think Kathy knows where he is, but the process of getting into the prison is a 6 to 8 week vetting process. Kathy has not seen her husband since he was convicted.
Mm-hmm. Holy crap.
I mean, I just want that to kind of like, no matter which side you fall on this, in terms of the way that they closed him off from that woman that was so fucking critical for his ability to stand upright as a human being, because he was that dependent on her. He had this dependency disorder that he just never thought he was good enough. He just never thought that people liked him. He just never thought that he was good enough for people to love him. And that was a real thing. And it way predated any of these crimes, as did his depression. So that's the fragile eggshell that you're dealing with coming into that incarceration thing. And whether they knew it or they didn't know it, and I'm talking about the state, and all those players that put him in.
They didn't care. You think they give a damn about emotions or mental health?
They didn't give a fuck, man. But like, they didn't realize when they were doing what they were doing just how easy it was going to be to crack him. You know, because when they shut him off from any, like, and I don't give a shit that he could be on a tablet calling his wife, not being able to lay eyes on her and have her be in front of him, whether it's behind plexiglass or not, and have her, because I'm assuming, because he wasn't a convicted felon, that she would have been able to sit with him in a room without a piece of glass in front of him, because the guy is a pretrial detainee, not a convicted fucking felon. You can't have him in prison under the same rules that you have for the convicted felon. Like, every time I would hear them say, oh, well, you know, we made more accommodations for Richard. Well, you're supposed to. He's a fucking pretrial detainee.
Yeah.
He's sitting in there, an innocent man, you jag off. The rest of those people in that prison are all convicted murderers and rapists.
Yep.
And this guy is not that. And you're treating him as though he is. You know, it's like that, the whole incarceration side of that. Yeah. Anyone that looks at that objectively and is like, you know, I'm good with it, they can fuck right off. Like,
yeah.
This is not how we can run shit in this country. It's like you said, T, it's a slippery slope, bro. You know, if you say it's okay here, then what's to stop?
And I think we have a weird way of doing things because we have laws in this country and then we have rules within a system. And it seems the two seem to turn into a gray area of what actually one has rights to do. And you know, laws tend to overstep rules. But when it comes to something like this, why were there no, or are there, did the system work as directed, I guess is the question. Were the laws followed? Was everything that was done to him, putting him in solitary confinement, basically torturing him for all of those years, or for that year, a little bit more than a year, was that all completely legal? Was that following the letter of the law as the way the law works?
No, it violated, okay. If you look at it, world rules in terms of,
I'm talking Geneva Convention. I'm just talking like how our system.
Yeah, but like
law versus world, and I agree there. I think it's insane, no matter what. But I'm wondering when we complain about like, well, this is crazy. It shouldn't be this way. Of course, nothing should be the way anything is. But did it work within what's allowed to happen based on the law?
No.
Okay. It's in the open. It's not like any of this was secretive. It's all out there. It's all documented what was done. Why can there be no if the laws were broken, then there should be repercussions for those people who broke those laws.
But there has to be some sort of standard and somebody as a gatekeeper. And it just doesn't, at least in this case, it doesn't feel like there is.
And if you can't prosecute it, then it wasn't a law that was broken.
So here's the workaround for it. There's what the standard is in terms of how long you're allowed by law to keep somebody in solitary. They didn't consider the wording that the government would use is that he wasn't in solitary. He was in a single person cell.
They just renamed it.
I know.
Yeah, right. What's the difference?
Here's the thing. And then the other part of it, T, is that he was in under a safe keeping order. So that's why the defense kept going in and saying, okay, enough with the fucking safe keeping order, because that's what they were using. Like the safe keeping order was the thing that was preempting what is humane, because they were claiming that if they didn't keep him in this isolated area, that either he was going to kill himself and or one of the other inmates was going to kill him. So that was their reasoning behind it. So that was why the defense went in on multiple occasions. That's when they were trying to get rid of the safekeeping order. That's what they were trying to do. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, okay, we've got Cass County here. It's a brand new facility. It can definitely handle Richard Allen. They could keep him in, you know, in a segregated area, and he's not going to be in the most secure area, in the most secure prison in Indiana, being screamed at by, he's a child killer. By fucking,
Odinist guards.
Odinist guards. So, you know, and Gull just kept rejecting it until she didn't on the eve of trial. Like when they finally transported him to Cass County for trial, she's like, I'll get rid of the safekeeping order now. We'll just keep him at Cass through
just
trial.
Change
that
the names.
So much easier.
I tell you what, I got some asbestos to sell her. I just changed the E to the B to a D. Asbestos.
Nice.
It's lovely. It's a great product. Totally safe. The name slightly changed.
Hey, I started messing with that last night.
Those of you who don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, we Sora, the AI. I created a commercial for asbestos. but seriously,
what is it? What is it? Bill's Warehouse.
Oh, Bill's House of Deals also sells asbestos. Yes,
yeah,
but it's seriously. I mean, if that's how this can work, we're just going to call it something different. It's exactly the same, to basically check the box and say that we're doing it right, which is basically what. So that's how, that's their workaround.
That was the workaround. It was that simple, that safe. You know, but here's where the problem for them with that safekeeping order is, because you can, like in this case, you can follow it, you know, from the breadcrumb trail. Like when they got him on the safekeeping hearing, it happened without Richard Allen being present in court and without him having a representative on his behalf in court. It happened basically under cover of darkness. So yeah. And the problem being that Richard Allen had the ability to, pursuant to the safekeeping statute, say, "Hey, look, here's the deal, man. I understand what you're saying. I understand your concern for me. However, I'm good with it. So just put me where you're going to put me." Like, he had the right to say that. The fact that he, because if this would have been like a strictly ministerial type thing, when, you know, they're just saying, okay, well, there's nothing that the defendant could have said or done that would have changed what happened there. Mm-hmm. Then it's not as much of an issue as it is where there is something that he could have said and done during that hearing that would have changed the end result, because that safekeeping hearing and then the resultant order that was entered started everything for them. You know, I mean, and it went down the road and, you know, and it ended up where it ended up.
So does Kathy have communication? Like, can she visit him if she wanted to? I mean, I know, like, there's visitation and stuff sometimes in prisons.
That's what I'm saying.
What are her rights? Like, what if she wanted to, can she
be approved?
Still,
as we sit here right now, she's still, because remember, they moved him.
How long does that take to get approved?
She told me 6 to 8 weeks. And I'm like, well.
So then start the process.
Aren't we past that by now?
She's up and started the process.
Jesus.
This isn't Kathy sitting around not trying to see Rick Allen. This is her trying to see him when they first got him incarcerated. And then they move him. You get a new facility, new DOC. You got to start the whole thing all over again. It's like, I wouldn't be surprised, frankly, if they move him fucking again.
Just to keep moving, to stop the...
I cannot put it past anybody at this point. And yes, I am from Chicago. Insane. Jagoff is definitely a...
Yeah.
I think it's a Midwestern thing. Did you ever say Jagoff coming from Wisconsin?
Yeah, in high school.
I think it's a Midwestern thing. In Gabagool. The Gabagool. Hey,
I learned that on Sopranos. I said fuck Jack a lot. Todd says fuck Jack a lot, too. I learned fuck Jack from Todd.
It's quality.
I say fuck nut.
Yeah. Fuck nut's good, too.
Yeah.
Fuck nut's good, too.
It's exasperating hearing this.
It's scary. You know, it's exasperating and it's scary to think. If we have fair trials, like we're not sitting here doing this shit.
Let me ask you this, because obviously, you know, to go to trial, you have to be, you know, competent enough to participate in your own defense. What about his competence? I mean, again, I'm not saying anything crazy here, but let's just say that, you know, a little bit down the road here, I mean, he has, can his attorneys get in touch with him?
I mean, yes. I've heard that appellate counsel was able to see him recently in Oklahoma.
So if he's of sound mind, okay, but what about when he's not? What about, you know, if... when that happens
and how do you know,
or if that happens,
you know, I'm saying people have this misconception about mental illness and psychopathy and psychosis and paranoia.
It's not glaring like it was before, right, where he's eating poop.
Right. He's not sitting there eating a shit. But what I'm saying is that you could be sitting right across from somebody that is diagnosed, paranoid schizophrenic, who is medicated, you would not ever know.
Sure.
Because they're acting completely normal. They're not having the paranoid, you know, thoughts and, you know, delusions of grandeur and all the shit that comes along with it. Like, people have this thing in their head based on the fucking movies they've watched throughout their life, thinking that everybody that's got mental illness has to be frothing at the mouth and acting like, oh, that's
But what do you do when he's so broken down? I'm just theoretically saying, what if he's back to the way he was while incarcerated the first time and he's going around saying he did it? You know, I mean, how do you continue appeal on that? How do you continue to defend that if he's not even mentally there to participate and he's convinced he did it, even though he didn't? But that's the state of being in it to which he is. What do you do? I mean, they basically broke it down so much. It's hard to walk that back, even though the person is damaged because of the system, not because of any sort of crime they committed.
Yeah, I mean, I know, man. It's like my whole thing with this is that the people that are like, oh, you know what? He confessed 25 times. I'm like, okay, well, I listened to him and him saying I did it. And then in the next scene saying, well, you know, when Kathy's saying, no, you didn't, they're fucking with you. And you know, and he's saying, well, maybe I did, you know, or evidently I did. Like, mm-hmm. That is not a fucking confession.
No.
Like,
no.
If anybody feels comfortable in this chat with having that serve as a confession, if it was on you, then I don't know what to tell you.
No, but everybody likes to go, it won't happen to me. It couldn't be me.
Like, if I'm not exactly sure what's going on, if I'm kind of slipping in and out of reality because of the confinements of my condition or the conditions of my confinement, which is going to happen to you. You're going to lose the concept of night and day. You're going to have sleep deprivation, like all the things that are happening to you that are going to be the way they're going to affect the way that your mind works, man. It's just here's where I'm at with it. Wouldn't it have been much nicer to just had him in holding in, you know, like say Cass County. And then if Richard Allen starts saying things like, you know what, I did this to the girls, or if he wrote the warden or the keeper of the jail in Cass County, hey, you know what? I really just want to be able to apologize to the families. And he's been kept under normal circumstances. And then you're not doubting the veracity or the credibility of those confessions. What they did to him made it impossible for me to give those things any weight.
Yep.
Sure.
You know, and that's where I'm at with it.
I got a question for you, because you and Allie on an episode not long ago on Defense Diaries, you were talking about the exclusion of the 3:12 a.m. jail call, where Allen allegedly lucidly professed his innocence. So if we have the ones where he's, you know, they're throwing in the ones where he's saying he's guilty, but we're not including the ones where he's professing his innocence. Tell me about that, because that was new to me when I started hearing about that.
Yeah. So like that particular circumstance with Allen, and it was so at trial, you know, which is when we're all first hearing about, you know, the details of these confessions. Mm-hmm. And Brad Rosie, who was again one of Allen's attorneys, before the morning session is going to start, because what we're going to be hearing in open court is finally the recordings of these confessions, these phone mm-hmm. calls between Richard Allen and his wife, and Richard Allen and his mother, and then Richard Allen and the conversation with his stepfather Ken. Yeah. So the way that it goes down, and the first thing that happens that morning is Brad Rosie comes in and says, okay, well, I've been made to understand that the state is planning on playing two phone calls from April. I believe the date's April 3rd. And we are asking the court that they play the call that preceded it, because they're all part of under the completeness doctrine. Mm-hmm. That they're all part of basically a continuing phone call, because the way it went down is, which of course Gull rejected, and Gull said, you know what, you know how you can get that in, Mr. Rosie, you can have your client get up on the stand and testify, and then I'll allow it in. So she basically was trying to strong arm them into having Richard Allen go up on the stand, despite not really knowing what his mental state is, in having your client testify in open court. Pretty scary proposition. But so ultimately, we end up, Brad reads the transcript in court. So that, and then obviously that was entered into the record as evidence. So, you know, when the evidence was recently released, we got the transcript of it. And it's essentially Rick calling at 3:30 in the morning or 3:15 in the morning. And he says, hey, you know, hey, mom, I need to talk to dad. And the whole conversation was mind blowing. I was seeing if I could just pull it up. It's like,
Is the audio released or is it just the documentation?
No, there is no, I have not gotten the audio for it. I would love to have the audio. I'd love to have all the audio, you know, because like, here's the thing that people just are not, well, before. So essentially he tells his father, who's his stepdad. He's like, dad, I just wanted to tell you, you know, how much I love you. And, you know, I wanted you to know that, you know, you, like, I've always felt how much you always had my back, you know, because like Ken really raised Rick and you know, and Rick had had an episode a couple of years before these things went down where Rick was suicidal. As I said, you know, there was a thing at the house, you know, where he was threatening to kill himself. And you know, and again, this predates the homicides, right? Yeah. And he thought that that was as a result of him doing, you know, had nothing to do with it. Again, it had to do with his mental illness that he's had since he was a teenager with the, you know, major depressive disorder and shit like that. So at any rate, he's like, you know, I drew away from you like after that episode because like you're not really, like you don't really get into the emotions. Like that's not your thing, you know? So I didn't want to put that shit on you. I didn't want to like make it so that you were going to have conversations with me about that. So he's getting into that. And then, you know, and he says there, he's like, there, you know, he's like, but I feel like I don't know how much longer I'm going to be lucid. I don't know how much longer I'm going to maintain my sanity. I can feel it. You know, he's like, they're not, he's like, I don't think they're torturing me physically, but they're psychologically torturing me. And he's saying all this shit. He's like, this is like, I feel like I'm in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. You know, like that's where, like, that's what he said. So he's like, that's where I feel like I am. And that's so I've gotten to the point where I can't talk to mom and Kathy anymore because it's just, it hurts me so much to hear how much it's hurting them, you know, and I just and I don't want to keep doing that to them. So I think it's better if I don't continue to communicate with them because I don't know what I'm going to say. Like, and he's saying all this shit, man. This is at 3:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
Okay. And then he goes on to say, you know, I think that they're trying to extort money from y'all. So he's like, you know, it's like, I don't want you to put money on my card. He's like, I have coffee. Like I'm okay. I'm, you know, and I'm good as long as I just have the coffee. He's like, I don't want them. I'm afraid that they're going to be trying to extort money from you. I don't want Kathy and you guys to be like putting any money towards a lawyer because like I feel like they're just extorting our money and it's not going to do anything. And like ultimately, you know, he's like, I think that they really think that I did this and I don't know why. He's like, I honestly don't know why they're trying to pin this on me. The only thing that I can think of, and he said this shit which blew my mind, which I now know, and I don't know if Brad or Andy thought of this independently, but he's like, I just know that there was an election for sheriff right after the Iraq.
Ooh.
You know, and like he adds that in there, like during this call. And so.
And they needed to find the boogeyman because the other boogeyman died.
Yeah. So like ultimately they end up ending that call. And then at 8:30. Same morning, still like he calls Kathy and then he's like, and he sounds like, I can't tell you if he sounds different because I haven't heard what he sounds like in that. But, you know, again, he's not like he can make words, which I think people mistake for him being lucid. The fact that he can make words, when you look at what he was saying 5 hours earlier, now he's getting on a phone with Kathy, and he's like, I just called to say I'm sorry. She's like, for what, hon? He's like, I did it. She's like, what?
We heard that one. I remember that one.
Right. Yep. We've all heard that one.
It was heartbreaking.
Yeah. And that's, you know, and then he's like, well, evidently I did it. You know, they're saying that I did. So like, and then there's a third phone call and she's asking, he's asking Kathy, which is where the argument was that they were really a continuing call or that you needed the context of that 3:30 call. She's like, did I call my dad?
Yeah.
Did I call my dad today?
He didn't remember.
Like, yes, hon. Yeah. I think you did. And he's like, and what did I say to him? Like, I couldn't tell if that was Richard Allen trying to, that he has somebody standing outside the cell, that he's saying I did it, and he's trying to code Kathy back to, I want you to ask my dad what I said during that conversation at 3:15 in the morning. You know what I mean? I don't know if that, like, who knows, man? It's like the whole thing is insane.
There obviously is some sort of cover up going on here or avoiding of anybody being responsible for what the hell is going on here. And I don't know if that's because there's someone's covering for who the real killer is. I don't know if they even know who the real killer is, honest to God. I certainly have my suspicions. I know you do, too. And I think he's dead. But it could as very well be yogurt shop-ish, too, where a transient comes into town and does that. That could be a very real possibility. But
yeah, I think Critter Mama, and I don't know if it was Stacey or Todd who threw that comment up, and they're like, there's nothing crazy about that.
No,
Mama. Well, because Critter Mama said, like, yo, well, here comes my crazy coming out. It's like, I don't necessarily think it's any of these people.
But
it absolutely could be a fucking random who just happened upon a stink park trail or, you know what I mean?
But I'm trying to figure out the insane amount of motivation that, I mean, it's a system, but it's a system run by people. And what those people behind the system that are using the levers and the rules of the system to railroad this guy every which way in such obvious fashion with no repercussion and no checks and no balances here going on. What is the goal of this other than is the system trying to protect itself? Because if it were to be exposed or were to be found guilty, and the people who made these poor decisions in this whole process were to have been found of basically ripping human rights away from this man and destroying his life and destroying his family life and the lawsuit and the dollars that would follow that would then be needed to be repaid to these families because of this. Is it all about that at the end? Is this at the end just, you know, Delphi trying to cover their ass because they don't want this to be another making a murderer situation where they have to pay millions of dollars to someone and have a big black eye? But then you go so far, you have so many other, you have so many systems at play here. He's in Oklahoma now. And I mean, so who's pulling the levers? Because it's not even the original people pulling them anymore, but they all seem to have this same, let's go and destroy Richard Allen motive.
Yeah. I mean, look, I agree, because look, it's one of three things. Well, maybe one of four things, right? It's either somehow, some way, they got the right guy and they just had a really shitty case and kind of got lucky and got the conviction and they have the right guy, right? So they're
even if he's the right guy, you wouldn't treat him this way.
I know. So you've got that thing.
Yeah.
Is in the realm of possibilities. You've got the concept that they knowingly understand that he's not the guy and did the most evil thing humanly possible to another human being short of killing them. And you railroad him to convict him for a crime that he didn't commit knowingly. Or the other is that their incompetent investigation left them with very little evidence. And this guy was the best fit. And they were going to go in there and they were going to hammer a square peg into a round hole, which is exactly what they did. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, like one of those things is the truth, you know, and like, I don't know. I mean, I hope to God it's three. Like, I hope it's not two. I hope that the depths of the evil didn't go to the extent where you got a guy running for sheriff. It's been five fucking years. And they're like, all right, this guy was out there. We can't exclude his shell. Let's make our run at him. You know, he doesn't not look like the guy in the video. We're not going to do any kind of, you know, calculations. And what do they call that? Telegrammatter. What is that? Where the grammatra, whatever. There's somebody in the chat will know, like, where you can tell what the measurement of that fuck.
Oh, yeah. Why didn't they do any of the, yeah, I know you're talking about.
Yeah.
Telemetry or something. Yeah. Like, why?
It's
why?
Mathy for me.
Yeah. Why not do all of the, and sometimes, I mean, and I also wonder too, I mean, because if it is number two, and they're doing it for a nefarious purpose of winning an election, which, again, this happens quite often. People will say things, do things to win an election. I'm not saying that's what happened here. I don't know the answer to that question. But I don't think a lot of times people realize the evil as to which they're conducting themselves in the moment. And the repercussions of that evil, when you take a step back and you see exactly what that all did. Well, where did this happen? How did, like, who made these choices? Oh, that looks like a really evil choice. Well, at the time, did you think it was an evil choice? No, I thought I was winning an election.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out what you did was evil.
Yeah.
if that's what you did. And I don't care whether you did it, you realized it at the time. It is what it is. And you can call it what you want, just like you can call putting someone in solitary confinement and making them eat their own poop after a while, that it's some sort of special consideration or whatever the hell they called it to label it something different. It's still the same damn thing. The consequences are the consequences.
Yeah.
I
don't know, man.
What are the next steps in the never ending saga here? Of Richard Allen now.
Well, the next thing that's going to happen definitively is that his brief will get filed, and then the state, and I think the attorney general is preparing the appeal on behalf of the state. Their response. So they'll file their response. They'll probably get 30 days. They'll probably ask for an extension. So eventually, both the briefs will get filed, and at some point, the appellate court may allow oral arguments, in which case I'll be in Indiana with bells on for that.
How far down the road is that?
I'm hoping by January or February, I'm hoping everything's filed by January.
No.
Like December would be nice, but with the holidays, it's just, I don't know if it's
sure.
Really
sure. Yeah. So. I mean, that can throw, yeah. I get so, yeah. I'm gonna need
well,
to go.
That's it, dude. But I mean, look, when the appeals come out, bro, we're gonna have a lot to talk about.
We are.
When the briefs are out, it'll be a lot to talk about.
This is a case. Yeah, this is why we keep talking about it, because this needs to continue to be not fall under the cracks. And I appreciate you, obviously,
never dropping the ball on this.
And
I honestly do. There's. Yeah. You know, you're one of the few creators that's got a nice sized audience that's still like sticking to his guns and keeping the thing kind of in the public's mind, because there's so much shit going on. You know, there's so many cases. There's so much awful, awful shit going on. It's easy to allow things to slip through the cracks. So I really do appreciate the fact that you continue to stay the course, man. You as well, Bob.
Such a screwed up story. Let us know your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube if that's where you're watching us. If not, search Hidden Killers the Tony Bruschi and you will find us there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever it is you're listening or watching us as well, so you don't miss any of our coverage on this and the many cases we got for you right here. Until next time, for Bob, for Todd, for Stacy, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com. This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Yeah.